Your Steve Jones Show podcast audio is loading. Steve Jones Show podcast, sponsored by Kratzer Insurance Agency, Mount Pleasant Mills in Northumberland, and online at KratzerInsurance.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
It is Tuesday. That means Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland, auto, home, life, business insurance. They take care of all your insurance needs. And on top of that, they have a very simple motto that screams to all of you. Service and price mean everything to them, because they know it means everything to you. That is Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. When you're in business 99 years, repeat customers make a go. You will find out why they have so many repeat customers the first time you buy from them, which we strongly suggest you do. They will take good care of you. Very good care of you. Scott Goodyear joins us in the next half hour from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Our thanks to Larry Schenk, who joined us in the previous half hour to talk about his 44 years of working with the Philadelphia Phillies. Super Bowl 52 will go to Minneapolis. Coach's caravan was in Williamsport earlier today. They go to Wilkes-Barre tonight. So that continues. The vast majority of the football team, if not almost all of them, are here in the first semester. There have been times where players have taken the first semester off, and then they come in the second semester, and then they get that work done. Expect the football players to be here for both of the six-week sessions. They will be here the entire time.
Actually,
which means they'll be working out on their own. I had a little talk with Christian Hackenberg on Saturday, and he's taking two classes in the six-week session that started yesterday. He'll be taking one class in the second six-week session in July and early August.
You mentioned that the caravan was in Williamsport. Barry in Williamsport, having been at the caravan, wanted to comment. Barry, you still there?
No.
Yes. Hello?
Hey, hi, Barry. How are you?
Hey, good. Steve, how are you?
Great.
We just finished the caravan not too long ago here at Penn College, and it appears that we're off for an exciting season in 2014. I just want to get your thoughts on it.
I think it's going to be an exciting, fun season to watch, and there certainly is a lot of talent on this football team, Barry. But at the same time, the area I'm cautious about is because of the offensive line. And when
Correct.
You go through a 12-game grind, you know, one of the things that the sanctions were designed to do was to cripple the football program with 65 scholarships, which they were down to at the end of last year. Well, they've started the build back up, and the build back is going to be with youth, but it also cripples your depth. And the depth on the offensive line and the depth of linebacker are a couple of areas to be concerned with. When you take the first team group on both sides of the ball for Penn State, the first team group can compete with anybody in the conference. You know you have arguably one of the two or three best quarterbacks in the conference, you know, behind center. You have three really good tailbacks. And obviously you have some, you know, I think the receiving core is going to be bolstered by the freshmen that are coming in. The offensive line depth is going to be bolstered by people coming in as well. And so that's the biggest concern, is going to be the depth. I think everyone felt that with the sanctions, 14 could be the bottoming out year. Well, I think there's more optimism about 14 after watching spring practice, but it doesn't mean they're not out of the woods in a couple of areas that were out of their control because of the sanctions.
Good. Okay. One quick question for you.
Yeah.
Did you get my email about coming to Williamsport?
I have, but I haven't worked it out yet, so that's why okay. I can't get back to you. I'm still trying to work on it. Okay.
Well, I was sitting here waiting on my wife. Okay, at an appointment, and I saw the ad in the paper for the radio station. So I thought, well, that's a good time for me to call you. Okay.
Perfect. Well, you call anytime, Barry. It's always okay. great talking with you.
All right. Look forward to hearing from you. Okay. All right.
Same
thanks
here.
A lot.
Thanks,
okay,
Barry.
Yeah. Bye bye. Yeah. Bye bye.
All right, it's 800-795-9565. Look, that's what the sanctions were meant to do. The sanctions were meant, you know, to knock the football. When you sit there and you see the NCAA attorney basically lay out that there were two options, there'll be no football on Saturdays, or you have to accept what we put together here. There's no negotiation. Well, what they put together were a series of penalties that are supposed to cripple the football program. Yeah, we'll let you limp around for a while, but we're gonna cripple it. We're gonna put you 20 scholarships behind the eight ball across the board. You're not gonna be allowed to go to a bowl game, and we're going to allow people to transfer freely without having to sit out at all. You know, so there'll be no penalty of transfer whatsoever. That was designed to have. I'm not gonna stay there. I'm gonna get the heck out of there, and some guys did. Then it also caused Bill O'Brien to now start paring back the roster because he knew he could only have 65 scholarships, which kept the Christian Hackenberg class from having more numbers in it. I mean, if you recall, I think they only had 11 in that recruiting class, you know, because the limit was going to be 15. Well, there were only 11 in that class because you're trying to keep it to 65. Now, obviously, with the revelation in early September of last year that there could be a boost to 75 this year, a boost to 80 next year, and then 85 the year after, well, that started to change and turn some things around. But you cannot wave a magic wand and voila, you have instant depth on the offensive line. Voila, you have instant depth at linebacker and on the football team. But there are still areas of this football team that are really good. I like the defensive line a lot. I like the secondary a lot. The first team linebackers I really like. You know, Mike Hall must stay healthy. If he does, along with Brandon Bell and Naeem Wortman, they're going to be really, really good. You've got plenty at running back. So, I mean, that's not an issue. You've got plenty at running back. And you've plenty at tight end. The question is, now you get to wide out. And at wide receiver, I think the incoming freshmen are going to make a big impression at the wideout spot. And special teams will be good. Chris Gould is going to be just fine. And Sam Ficken, now that Ryan Kaiser is back as the holder, that's a big difference maker for him. And people forget that Sam Ficken with Ryan Kaiser as his holder got off to a fabulous start, and then Ryan broke his hand. And when he broke his hand, that meant he could not be the holder any longer. So they went to brought in Adam Geiger, and then from Adam Geiger they transitioned to Alex Butterworth. So the guy went through three holders last year. That's important because Ryan Kaiser has a real feel for how Sam Ficken likes the ball at certain spots of the field. Exact angle, where the laces need to be, and so forth. And you cannot discount that. And getting him back, Ficken had a great spring because Kaiser was back as his holder. So, yeah, optimism? Yeah, plenty of optimism. And James Franklin's going to bring that optimism with him as well because he gets in front of people. He is well-spoken. He is dynamic. He is somebody that, that people can... that can jump on board with. And I think that's a big part of this. The fact that he's, that people hear him, talk with him, and listen to him, and they realize that this is the kind of leader that they want. And that's where this caravan has been great. 17 stops. There will be, I think they're 14 down now and 3 to go. One tonight in Wilkes-Barre, then they finish out tomorrow. Then that'll be it. But he will have introduced himself to the region. He will have introduced himself throughout Pennsylvania. Harrisburg, Philadelphia, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Pittsburgh. I know he goes to Northwestern Pennsylvania tomorrow, and I think he goes to Erie and Sharon tomorrow. New York State College. He's been in Williamsport today. He's been able to introduce himself up close and personal, I think, to as many people as possible. There'll be a lot of demands on him and on his time. There has to be a point now out of this where two important things have to happen for him. Number one, back to being the football coach. He doesn't have to be the publicity guy, the ticket guy, and all that, and, you know, has to wear all those hats. Okay, he's been doing that now for the last 3 weeks. Back to being the football coach, back to being around his football team, but also getting his family here. That'll be important for all the coaches across the board once school is over with, for them to get their families here to State College, because they've been, for the most part, I think they've almost all been working without them here. Now, there's some pluses to it. You don't have distractions or anything like that, but at the same time, it's not a normal situation to be in. And it's not as comfortable as to what you're used to and so forth. And they're very family-oriented people. And that's something he's tried to convey to everybody across the board, that relationships are critical and families are critical. I mean, he's tried to relate that, and he treats his football team like that. When he looks at his football players and talks to them about graduating in 3.5 years, he's dead serious about that. That, of course, jumps the APR, but at the same time, he wants them all walking out with degrees. That's why he doesn't really want them taking semesters off. That's why the entire football team is here in the first six-week session that started yesterday. That's why they're all going to be here for the six-week session that starts right around the end of June, right around July 1st, into mid-August. Because he wants them all here, working out, and taking academic pressure off of them. As I mentioned, Christian Hackenberg told me Saturday, he says, Steve, I'm going to take two courses in the first 6 weeks and one in the second. Well, that's going to be 9 credits he doesn't have to worry about. It also keeps him on campus, puts him in a spot where they're working 7-on-7, allows him to be a leader and organize, and also to get familiar with his teammates. Now, that second session, six-week session, will be very important for Christian Hackenberg, because those talented young wideouts that were all recruited and signed in February, starting at the end of June, will all be here. There's only one that was here during the course of the spring practice. That was DeAndre Tompkins, who's very, very good. You can see, obviously, why he was highly sought after, with his speed, decent hands, looks like a good route runner, and now has a better feel for how Christian throws the ball and has a better feel for John Donovan's offense and working with Josh Gattis. But the other wideouts will then come in, including Blacknall and that entire group, at the end of June, right around July 1st, and it'll be critical for them to get out there and work with Christian Hackenberg. Hackenberg will have more flexibility to work with the younger receivers because he'll be taking just one class instead of two. But he'll get 9 credits over the next 12 weeks at Penn State while working with his teammates, and that takes the academic burden off of him. When you go into the fall, I mean, you can take 9, 12 credits if you want, but it just, you know, at a time when you're just supposed to be working with your group, it takes the stress factor off the table, because you can do your work, do your film work and things like that, and you only have 2 classes, only have 1 class, but you're building up 9 extra credits that'll help you down the road and ease the burden. Smart all the way around. And I like the fact that, you know, I know there are moments where you need time off and time away from this, but you do get that because, for the most part, there are not a lot of professors here that do the finals thing. There are a lot of professors that take that last week of class and they give that final then. And you usually get, I want to say, 2 weeks in between the end of the semester and the start of the first 6 weeks. So you get those 2 weeks off. So you're off, you get some time off. Now it allows them to get back here, get some credits, get back to work. It's the way football's become. It's the way basketball's become, too. Now, Patrick Chambers is taking a different approach in basketball. A lot of guys, I think, are going to take this first six-week session off. but they'll all be back for the second one, every one of them. Because he felt like after a long season, and this includes the trip to Europe, which was in August last year, he felt they needed time off. Football needs the opposite. When you don't have a bowl game, you have a coaching transition. So from November 30th, when they played at Wisconsin, you know, they didn't get back out there until the middle of January and started working with Dwight Gault. Well, that's where they had their time off. You know, obviously some guys still work, but that's still where they had their time off, was in that area. And hopefully in August, despite what's happening in courtrooms and things like that, there'll be more givebacks, including a bowl game, because look, the second you can tell me what Christian Hackenberg has done wrong, then I'll accept the zealot's argument as to what should be done here. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to insurance, let's face it, the options and the sources keep changing. It gets confusing. Do you really know what you're getting? Better yet, do you know what you're not getting? Save time and save your mind with a simple call to the Kratzer Insurance Agency of Mount Pleasant Mills or Northumberland. For 51 years, the Kratzer Insurance Agency has been keeping the Susquehanna Valley insured and protected from whatever comes our way. If your policy is up for renewal, or you suffer the disappointment of cut-rate insurance deals on the internet or over the phone, then listen. Don't sacrifice personal service. The Kratzer Insurance Agent, your independent agent, has your best interest in mind. Of course they have competitive prices.
Hi, this is Kim Ebright. Call us, stop in, or visit us online at KratzerInsurance.com.
Standing together against whatever. Family, friendship, security. The Kratzer Insurance Agency.
While looking for a vehicle, you know that if it sounds too good to be true, chances are it is too good to be true. You get the runaround, gotta go from place to place. Well, you can just skip all of that and go straight to Sunbury Motor Company. Sunbury Motor Company has been satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915, so you know they've got it right. No offers that look good on paper or online, and then you get disappointed when you see them in person. Sunbury Motor Company offers a lineup few other auto dealers in the area can compete with. With the inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there will be no problem finding the right vehicle that fits your needs and your budget. And the friendly, knowledgeable staff's ready and able to help you with everything from the test drive to the drive off the lot. See for yourself at Sunbury Motors. Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. And Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Look for them online anytime at sunburymotors.com.
Those walls from Mid-Ohio to Toronto, they so we came to Road America where we burned up at the lake.
Okay. Steve in Northumberland. Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Good, Steve. I wanted to call, first of all, maybe the only other IndyCar fan in the area besides Kevin. You were talking earlier about why they didn't race at Daytona or Talladega, the IndyCar.
Yes, yep.
Back in the day, actually, NASCAR sanctioned a Champ car, but that was back when they were still front-engine roadsters, so they did race there a long time ago. But several years ago, they tested the IndyCars at Texas, and because of the G-forces, the drivers are blocking out, so that's why you'll probably never see them at those big tracks. They're just too fast.
Very true. Yeah, you're right about that. And again, it does come down to a safety issue. Certain tracks are built for certain kinds of racing, and they're probably not built for the kind of racing we're talking about.
Now, Indy cars are meant to be raced on a track with flat turns, certainly not those high banks. I think back in the 70s, A.J. Foyt had held the closed course speed record at Daytona in his Indy car, and that was, you know, one of the big old Coyotes he used to drive. So They'd be so incredibly fast there, it wouldn't be safe.
Yeah, it may not be, because I know that's one thing that blew them away at Pocono, was that the speed. They kept saying to Kevin and me over and over again, how many times did we hear Kevin from people, I can't believe how fast these people are.
Yeah, over and over and over again.
Yeah, the aerodynamics that play such a huge part in those cars as well, and that, you know, that's where they're getting a lot of that speed at that they didn't have because they've developed those aerodynamics over the years. The other thing that you had said about was at Nazareth. Nazareth, in the end, was actually owned by International Speed. Speedway Corporation that also owned Watkins Glen. Roger Penske sold it to them before he got out of it. So that's why they moved the Watkins Glen.
Yeah, I think I said that it was a Penske owned track, and that's why they moved him up to the Glen, because that's where the seats are.
He had sold it to ISC, the France family.
Right.
That's who still owns it, I believe.
Right. Well, it's an $18 million track to land, and I think between you, Kevin, and me, I think we could cobble together.
Let's do it.
About a thousand.
About $1,800 worth of it.
All right, you've got the first 1,000, Steve's got the 18, and I'll be just here to promote it for you.
There you go, fabulous. There's a plan, Steve. There's a real plan. We're proud owners of a track with weeds and trees growing in it. There you go.
Is that enough money to buy one turn, even? I don't even think.
No.
Maybe the start-finish line.
Yeah, well, there's probably something that we could afford.
Okay. Hey, Steve, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah, Scott Goodyear coming up in just a few minutes.
Yeah, I think that went back, Steve, to probably 06, because I think there was a test at Daytona around 2006 when they were just trying to figure out about the 100% ethanol mixture, too. And I think they tested both at the same time. I remember reading about it years ago.
All right. Scott Goodyear, friend of the show, first joined us when we were at Pocono last July. He'll step in from Indianapolis. We'll talk about qualifying. We'll talk about the 500 and the state of IndyCar racing today. Scott Goodyear next. Today's show brought to you by Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills and Northumberland, Auto Home Life Business Insurance. If service and price means something to you, it means everything to them. Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills, and Northumberland. Back with more from the Sunbury Motors Studio after the bottom of the hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Greetings, Mark Lawrence from WKOK's live telephone talk show, On the Mark.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills, and Northumberland Auto, Home, Life, Business Insurance. They have a very simple motto. They get it. Service and price mean everything to them because they know it means everything to you. That's Kratzer Insurance, Mount Pleasant Mills, and Northumberland. We're in the Sunbury Motors Studio, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, K Routes 11 and 15 in Hubbell's Wharf. We welcome back to the program a guy that joined us at Pocono last year when we did the show there, Scott Goodyear. Scott, welcome back. We hope the year has treated you well.
It has been, and it's in the month of May, so you know something, it's the best time of the year, I think.
No question about that. All right, let's talk about how the qualifying went. Ed Carpenter ends up on the pole for this thing. He only wants to run ovals. Why is it that he only wants to run ovals and then he passes off the car on Grand Prix style courses?
You know, it's interesting because Ed has been a mainstay in the IndyCar series for quite a few years, and obviously his stepfather, Tony George, being involved with the Speedway and the family being involved in the Speedway. So he's sort of, I guess, married into it, if you will, but a great driver coming up through what we call the old-style method, you know, through the dirt tracks and the midgets and what have you, and never ran road course racing until probably 5 or 6 years ago when he went and did the Daytona 24-hour. This IndyCar series now has a lot of road course races, street course races, so it's not just all about ovals like when Ed got involved. And for Ed, because he never did it, he just is not really that proficient at it. And luckily for him, he found a guy in Mike Conway, who won at Long Beach earlier this year, if you can recall, that decided Mike did not want to do oval racing any longer because he had two horrific crashes at Indy. Mike's from England, never did ovals in his career. So it was a nice marriage, if you will, between the two drivers that have specialty talents in each given area.
When you've watched qualifying and you've watched, obviously, practice runs, Scott, how consistent have the speeds been?
very, very consistent. And yesterday, Steve, it was like a race. I mean, they changed the format, as you know, for qualifying this past weekend, and they allowed right. all the teams to have one extra practice day on Monday yesterday. And it was like the Indy 500 race yesterday. Guys were just out there running. Now, there's a lot of guys that are consistent, maybe not as fast as they might need to be. There's a lot of guys that have found speed. And I noticed yesterday, late in the day, Scott Dixon, who for Target Chip Ganassi did not have a great qualifying effort. And although he's a past champion of this race and reigning series champion, a guy that's very fast everywhere he goes, you know, he and Tony Kanaan just didn't fare well qualifying. But yesterday, they were able to get through the pack and then fall back and get back up to the front. It looked like NASCAR racing, really. So I think it's going to be a shootout between probably a good 15 guys for the win on Sunday.
And that makes it an exciting proposition to broadcast when you have that many that have a legitimate opportunity of contending. So from your point of view, from the broadcast point of view, the excitement of knowing that you have competitors in 15 different spots.
Absolutely. And it's not just all about the big teams anymore. You know, we always used to talk about Penske and Andretti Autosport and Target Chip Ganassi. I mean, Ed Carpenter, with his own team, he's an owner-driver. It's almost like a throwback to the old days where guys used to come and work on their own cars and then wipe their hands off, put their suit on, and jump in the cockpit. So, you know, it's not like that today because there's obviously a lot of technology involved in these cars. But, I mean, for an owner-operator to come in, and he's a medium-sized team, beats all the big teams with larger budget, multi-car teams, and Ed Carpenter's on the pole at 231-plus miles an hour for an average speed. I mean, it's incredible, the speeds and the story that Ed's got there. You know, and there's so many stories all the way through. Obviously, we're guys, Graham Rahal and Marco Andretti, you know, both their families have won this race before, and they're each trying to get their name on the BorgWarner Trophy. I mean, there's stories all the way through here, so we're very excited.
Yeah, there are a lot of great stories without question. The Grand Prix, of course, had the standing start. There was the incident because of a stall. We know Indy's the rolling start. Your experience, what would you prefer? Did you ever prefer standing start, or did you always prefer a rolling one?
Well, I did both in my career, and I probably have over 100 standing starts underneath my belt. And I say that because I did a lot of racing in Europe and a lot of racing in Canada, and a lot of standing starts are done in both those areas. And you know something, I'm just not sure why that happened. They sounds like there was a system failure on the car. These cars are now in their third season, not maybe designed and built for standing starts, built for the rolling starts. So the manufacturers are going back and seeing what was going on. There's two more races this year, Toronto and Houston, that have standing starts on the schedule. From my perspective, you know, we need to make sure everything is fine before we try it again. I think it's exciting. I love it. I think the fans love it, but it needs to be done in a safe manner. I would not be surprised to see the IndyCar series bypass that for one more season, try it again next year. But, yeah, you know, and the Grand Prix that was here, what a great event. Drivers loved the new layout the Indianapolis Motor Speedway put together. They revamped the old Formula One track, and it was neat to see the IndyCars come race the road course, although to me, traditionalist Indy 500, they were going the wrong way, but that's okay.
That's exactly right. They were going the opposite way on the straightaway. That was remarkable to see. Now, for you, when you give me a quick tour of the track, when you take me into turn one, two, back straight, three, and four, what are the perils on each that each driver must have ingrained in their mind as to what they need to think of in each one of those areas?
Well, I'll take you to the very start. First off, the guys will be in the car on Friday and then a couple of days off, and obviously into the start on Sunday. So you haven't been in the car on race day, and you're out there with 32 of your best friends that really would like to push you off the racetrack, obviously. Then you need to take the green flag and rush down to turn one at about 200 miles an hour. And, oh, yeah, that's three wide, so you got to make sure you funnel into one lane. That's the most difficult part of that race, is the start and then also the restarts. But once you're up and going, a driver is very busy in the car, multitasking, looking at his computer dash. And remember, you're going down the straightaway, which are 5/8 of a mile long, and you're doing 225, 28, 230 miles an hour, depending on the lap. So you're traveling the length of a football field, in about 8/10 of a second, and you got to contend with getting your car right on spot into turn one, flat out, not lifting, going in there, like I said, 227, 230 miles an hour, and then set up for turn two, all the way down the back stretch, turn three, another fast turn, and you just keep doing it. You know, 200 times around there, you might think it gets a little bit boring, but you don't ever let your guard down, because if you do, you'll find yourself into the wall.
Is there an element of patience that is needed for the winner?
Absolutely. It was interesting. We did our national conference call today, and we were talking about many drivers and rookies, you know, including Sage Karam. You know, and obviously Kurt Busch, you can put him in a rookie uniform if you want. I mean, as far as the Indianapolis 500 is concerned, not for driving, obviously. But I always broke this race up into 5 100-mile races and learned from Rick Mears, continue to work on your car, get your car ready to go racing for the last 50 or 75 miles. If you do that, you'll be in contention. If you are impatient, and I said this on the conference call today, for the guys that are rookies and the guys that are coming back, like Montoya, and especially Jacques Villeneuve, who hasn't been here for 19 years, the 1995 winner, you get really anxious around 250, 300, 325 miles, because that's usually the length of a normal race. So your system and your muscle memory tells you it's time to get going. And when you do that, you generally make a bad decision and make a bad move and find yourself raising the wall or collecting yourself with another car. So, and that's where it's the responsibility of the team managers. Patience, patience, patience on the radio to the driver, especially the rookies.
We're with Scott Goodyear, who brilliantly takes us through race day at Indianapolis on ABC. We appreciate the time he's giving us today to talk about the race. You mentioned Kurt Busch in there. We know there's a certain approximate line that you run at Indianapolis in an Indy car. Is it any different than the line that they run at NASCAR when they run the Brickyard 400?
The line is different. Maybe by the visual eye, it may not seem that, but it is hugely different when you're driving a car like an Indy car versus a NASCAR. An Indy car weighs about 1,500 pounds. A NASCAR weighs 3,400 pounds. And Kurt even said himself, the thing that I'm trying to retrain myself to do is to go into the turn and not take my foot off the gas. Because if I did that sort of style driving in a NASCAR, I would go and probably try and knock the wall down. The car just won't do it. And the other side of it, too, is that these cars have downforce. And I always like to tell people that the underside of these Indy cars is built like an inverted airplane wing. So the airplane goes along the runway, and the faster it goes, the more lift it creates. Well, because it's inverted underneath our cars, the faster our cars go, the more suction down to the ground we have. And completely opposite to a NASCAR. So when we go into a turn, the car will go around the turn without taking your foot off the gas. And that's what Kurt really struggled with, to convince himself that he could do it. And he said, once I got it done, it was a lot of fun. Now, on the other side of that, too, is that what we saw yesterday for Kurt in practice when he's running in traffic is that when the car starts to slide, it's a different retrieval system program with the steering wheel than it is with a NASCAR. And he corrected, and when the car got grip again, the thing turned and rocketed itself into the wall at 215 miles an hour. So that's going to be the tough thing for Kurt, is to run in traffic. We have adjustments inside the cockpit on these cars. We can tune the chassis as we go, a little high-tech compared to NASCAR. So he's got to learn to use all the tools in there to adjust the suspension on the car when he races, and doing that at 225 miles an hour. So, yeah, multitasking is the term of the day.
Yeah, no question. Everyone finds their own comfortable line. When you ran there, and you ran brilliantly there, you had your own comfortable line. Munoz likes to take the thing below the white line. When you see that, what runs through your mind when he does that?
Last year, both Eddie Cheever, who's the other analyst in the booth, along with Alan Bestwick, who's the play-by-play this year, but both Eddie and I last year were looking at that and said that he'll never make it. Everybody in the garage area, even his team owner last year, Michael Andretti, said, you have to bring the car above the white line. You'll never make it. He survived. He ran down there all day long, still getting very, very close to the curbing. If you touch the curbing with these cars, because they sit so close to the ground, and as I mentioned before, that suction underneath the car, the inverted airplane wing, if you hit the curbing, it raises the car off the ground. It breaks that suction, and and the car will go into the wall. A NASCAR, you can get away with it. You see those guys doing it all the time. You can go down there as much as you want, but you touch that curbing one time, and then, as I say, in this racing business, you become a passenger, and you are going into the wall. So he survived. He's doing it again this year. A few other drivers are starting to do it. You're flirting with danger. We'll be watching that on race day on Sunday on ABC, and we hope it doesn't happen, but there's a good chance that somebody will push the limit too far.
And the broadcast, by the way, begins at 11 Eastern on ABC as well on Sunday, just to remind everyone. When you look at the practice runs, you look at, obviously, qualifying. Is there a discernible difference in car setup for a practice or qualifying as opposed to race day, and how important are those differences?
They are very different, and what happens is that on a qualifying attempt, you want the car to go as quickly down the straight as possible with just enough grip in the turns to be able to get through the turns, and you have to do that for four laps in a row. Remember, it's four total laps around here, and it's a total of 10 miles. It gives you your average qualifying time. So for the drivers, what we like to always say is that that's when you put your big boy pants on and make the money, because you know, the speeds that we saw this last weekend, routinely laps at over 230, 231 miles an hour average. We're talking 230 miles an hour, how fast they're going. It's really incredible. And yes, you have to really trim the car out to take all that aero load off the car to make it go fast. Now, for the race, you need to put all that aero, all the grip back into the car so you can run in traffic with cars around you, because qualifying is by yourself, and you can just run your own normal line trimmed out. You don't have to worry about all the cars in front of you. And we hear in NASCAR when they talk about, you know, I just couldn't get the front end underneath me, the front tires to bite. We have that in IndyCars. So when they're running in packs like they are right now, 6, 8, 10 deep, your car has to be set up differently for the race, and the people that get that right will be the most competitive on race day.
Mentally, what is it like for you to walk into the Brickyard on a Sunday of race day as a broadcaster, as opposed to the days you walked in as a driver?
You know, it's funny, when I started this in 2002 with Paul Page, we're up on top of the grandstands in the television booth, and we were up there early, probably 5:30, quarter six in the morning, and they had the gun go off, the bomb goes off, you know, open the gates at six, and you know, we're there for many hours before the telecast starts, and I kept saying to Paul, I go, hey, Paul, look what they're doing here. Look what they're doing over the bands coming and all this sort of stuff. And he let me go on for a couple of hours, and he looked at me and he goes, Goodyear, how many years do you race here? And I said, 11. And he said, they were doing all the same things that at that time when you were driving as they are today. And I looked at him, I go, Paul, as a driver, you come in here, you don't know anything that's going on. You get out of your bus, or you come from the hotel, go in the garage, meet with the team, the engineers. You are so focused on what you're going to do. The only thing you know is that your race car is sitting on the front stretch waiting for you. So a completely different way of life for me now. And now I understand how much more bigger this event is than I thought it was, because it's just neat to see on race day all the warmth, the color, the movement in the stands, because the crowd is there versus there during practice time when, you know, it's a pretty empty stadium.
We have great appreciation and respect for your insight and your work, and we thank you for the time you gave us today. Good luck on Sunday. We know you'll be terrific, Scott. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, guys. Look forward to it. Bye now.
Scott Goodyear with us from Indianapolis. He will be the analyst. Alan Bestwick and Eddie Cheever will work with Scott on Sunday at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the 500. We'll come back, get the Kevin Herr insight on the interview in a moment as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Everything that kills me makes me feel alive.
Better late than never, I thought, you know.
Well, there's another saying, too, better never late. No.
Also a very good saying, I must admit. Yes.
That's like one time somebody said, and I heard somebody else say, better, you know, somebody was supposed to do something at an event, and they showed up late, and the person looked at him, and he says, hey, man, better late than never. And the person who was hosting looked at him and said, yeah, better never late. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to back out of this conversation.
Can't really argue with that theory either. It's a very good philosophy.
Well, Scott Goodyear was on. And
I enjoyed every minute. As a matter of fact, I'm waiting for me to upload it to stevejoneshow.com, and I can listen to the podcast on the way home.
Well, you didn't hear it the first time?
I did, but there's a lot of stuff that I enjoyed so much I wanted to hear it again.
I mean, really, you weren't listening?
What? I was listening.
I mean, you're the one guy I count on. We pay you.
I was very closely listening, believe me.
I mean, something like, hey, like we get this guy cash, like we pay him to listen. Everybody else can do kind of do what they want. Not you.
I'm captive. I'm a captive audience.
You're the mandatory Sunbury Broadcasting hostage. So
yeah, you know, I love the story he told right at the end. You know, in one of the first couple of years doing it, going to the track as an announcer, sitting with Paul Page up top for hours before the race, going, "Oh, look at the band! Look what they're doing with this! Do this every year, Scott."
Yes. See, that spoke to you.
It did,
because the race is not really that important to you. It's the Open and Jim Nabors.
But it's the whole thing. It's the pageantry of it. And Scott, that's what Scott's talking about. Learning to appreciate that, because as a driver, he's never had the time to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember what he told us, though, in Pocono last year. And he was looking at Eddie Cheever, and they're passing him, weaving all over the place. And he says, "Were we like that?
Yeah. Did
well,
we do
yeah,
that?
We used to be like that." He goes, "No wonder we got out. No wonder we got out of this." That's a little bit too much.
Well, he and I were talking about the Indy 500, at Pocono last year, and I said to him, "What did you, as a call in the race, what did you think watching all that?" He goes, "I never saw so much passing, and I've never been so happy to be in the booth and not in the cockpit of the car."
Exactly. That's why Mark Jackson joined Jeff Van Gundy and back on TV.
Right.
And they're saying, you know, it might be only temporary. I'm thinking to myself, you know how safe you are in that booth? You don't lose any games.
All you have to do is ignore comments on Facebook and Twitter, and you're fine.
You know, and you work with one of the great pros that he guest lectured in my class one day, Mike Bream. Mike Bream is about as nice and as knowledgeable a guy as there is. I mean, I'm sorry, but if I'm Mark Jackson, I fulfill the multi-year contract to do broadcasting.